we've had distributed the article as well as the
briefly
spreadsheet, and as we've done, if we can offer Representative Hornstein and Senator Dibble just a chance to make some introductory comments.
Somebody here?
Yeah.
Senator Dibble?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's a good article. You should vote for it.
All right. Representative Hornstein, anything you might...
I would concur with my Senate colleague.
All right.
Mr. Chair, I mean, we will defer to staff to go over the budget articles with you, and then we have a couple of amendments. So I believe Representative Wagenius will offer. So,
well, if we could, I'm not sure who wants to start in terms of the presentation of the spreadsheet. And maybe just as we've done with others, just make sure we know, just remind all of us, the target for the article, both 15 and 16, 17. So who is, Ms. Boyd, are you? Okay.
Mr. Chair and committee, we'll start with a walkthrough of the spreadsheet. Excuse me. And as you mentioned, the target for transportation, that's at the bottom of the last page of the spreadsheet. You can see the right column say conference agreement. That the 15 number is 15 million for general fund, and the tails number is 4, so that's 2 million each in fiscal year 16 and 17. And Mr. Chair, some of the items have already been adopted, and I'll try to remember to point those out as we go through. Starting on the first page of the spreadsheet on the conference side, $4 million additional appropriation to airport development assistance was already adopted by the conference committee. The next, Greater Minnesota Transit, there's an additional $6.5 million one-time appropriation to Greater Minnesota Transit in fiscal year 15. There's also a $32,000 appropriation increase related to the provision to provide free transit rides on Election Day in November 2014. The next section is freight under the multimodal division and Department of Transportation. There's a statutory appropriation here related to the rail safety provisions in Article 12. These are assessments on the railroads to provide funding for additional rail safety inspectors. And you can see the appropriation amounts there, and that's from special revenue. There's also a $2 million general fund appropriation in fiscal year 15 for railroad grade crossing safety. This is for grade crossings along corridors in which oil or other hazardous materials are transported, again related to some of the provisions in Article 12. Moving down to safe routes to school. This is an ongoing appropriation of $250,000 for non-infrastructure activities of the Safe Routes to School program for grants to local jurisdictions. And then moving down to state roads, these provisions are all governor's recs and have all been adopted already by the conference committee. The notable pieces, I suppose, are the $20 million one-time appropriation increase for snow and ice removal, $10 million for winter-related road repair on trunk highways. There's $13 million collectively for some other operations and maintenance improvements. And then there's an ongoing $5 million per year appropriation to increase the replacement of snowplow equipment for the department. Moving on to page 2, still in state roads at MnDOT, the first provision has been adopted by the conference committee, the $3 million governor's rec for enhanced project management and the planning, program planning and delivery section of the department. There's also a $120,000 one-time appropriation from Trunk Highway Fund related to some work zone safety initiatives later in Article 12 of the bill or of the document. And this $120,000 is related to a later appropriation as well. This piece is for education and outreach for work zone safety initiatives, specifically speed limit changes in some work zones. State road construction, there's $35 million over 2 years from Trunk Highway Fund for the Trunk Highway 14 Turnback Project. The $14 million is from Trunk Highway Fund balance. The $21 million is from the Trunk Highway, but it's after a $21 million transfer into the Trunk Highway Fund from the flexible highway account for county turnbacks. There's the other piece on the next line for work zone safety initiatives, an ongoing $505,000 increase from Trunk Highway. This is for work zone costs, mostly for sign posting, equipment, signs, mileage, et cetera. Next is an appropriation for the Corridors of Commerce project. Part of this was already adopted by the conference committee, the $25 million appropriation in 2015. There's an additional $6.5 million appropriation from Trunk Highway in fiscal year 14, and that is specifically for Greater Minnesota projects in the Corridors of Commerce program. And Mr. Chair, that completes the MnDOT appropriations. The next section at the bottom of page two is for Metropolitan Council. There's a number of small appropriations here, all from the general fund. There's a $500,000 one-time appropriation related to new policy language later in the bill about new design specifications of transit shelters and some new maintenance standards for the shelters. There is a $144,000 one-time appropriation from general fund. This is the Metro Council, Metro Transit piece of the Election Day Free Transit Rides provision. There is $250,000 one-time appropriation from general fund for suburban transit providers. And those are the replacement providers or opt-out providers in the metro area. There is $1 million each for two projects, one of which is a BRT station for at the I-35W Lake Street interchange, and another $1 million for the Snelling BRT, the A-Line project, bus rapid transit along Snelling Avenue. And these are both one-time appropriations. There's a $60,000 piece. This piece was already adopted by the conference committee. This is just an appropriation shift of general fund money from Met Council to Department of Public Safety related to light rail safety oversight. On page three, start the Department of Public Safety appropriations. Again, there's a statutory piece. This is related to the rail safety account that, again, will be taken up in Article 12 of the document. This is spending related to $1.574 million one-time general fund transfer to the rail safety account. This is where the spending is shown in the Department of Public Safety. It also contains $1.25 million a year assessments against the railroads for 3 years to be deposited in the account. And off the top of that, $104,000 will be appropriated per year to the Pollution Control Agency for Environmental Protection Agencies, or I'm sorry, Environmental Protection Activities. The remaining money is appropriated to DPS for emergency response teams, firefighter trainings, et cetera. And then there's the $60,000 piece, again, already adopted by the conference committee, part of that shift from the Met Council light rail safety oversight. Next is the State Patrol. There's some money allocated from the Trunk Highway Fund for additional troopers. This is $5.949 million in fiscal year 15, and then there's an ongoing $5.5 million in the tails per year. This is to hold a trooper academy in 2015 and also to hire, train, and equip 48 additional state troopers. There's also an increase to capital security of $1.75 million per year starting in 15. That was a governor's request or a governor's recommendation. The governor's rec was at $2 million. We ended up at $1.75 million per year. Driver and vehicle services. There is a new provision later in Article 12 related to, or it's from the House side, related to improving driver exam scheduling. The provision in Article 13 says that driver's exams must be scheduled within 14 days of a request. This will require 12 additional FTEs in the department. So the amounts you see there from the Special Revenue Fund are related to those FTEs and their costs. And then the other two pieces are the $23,000. There's $23,000 each from the driver services operating account and the vehicle services operating account. That is to fund the expenses. They're one-time appropriations, the expenses of the task force on motor vehicle insurance verification. And the language related to that is in Article 13. On page 4 of the spreadsheet, there's just a few pieces I'm going to point out that are notable. Still includes the $6 million transfer from Trunk Highway Fund to Special Revenue, the Stillwater Lift Bridge Endowment Account. That is coming from the existing appropriation in the State Road Construction section of MnDOT, so that's not new Trunk Highway spending from the fund. Also, if you look on line 149 of page 4, there's the transfer from the general fund to the Railroad Safety Account. To be allocated to the Department of Public Safety of $1.574 million. And lastly, I'd like to point out on lines 164 and 165, this is a provision in Article 13 that removes the cap to the county allocation from the motor vehicle leasing sales tax. So here you can see the amount of $12.685 million is the revenues are changing from the Transit Assistance Fund that goes to Greater Minnesota Transit to the five collar counties through the County State Aid Highway Fund. And, Mr. Chair, that's the crux of the spreadsheet.
Okay, questions about the spreadsheet? And then we've got the article in front of us. If I'm not sure if it's either Burris or Ms. Brzozowski who are going to present it.
Mr. Chair and members, were you looking at Article 11?
Yes.
Then? That reflects the spreadsheet appropriations.
Okay. So nothing else to add?
There are two more articles there.
Yeah.
There's two attached to it.
Okay, so that's Article 11. We've also got...
Mr. Chair, maybe I should just point out the three, unlike our previous ones, the three articles are stapled together.
All attached.
Article 12 begins on page 20 and Article 13 begins on page 28, just for members' information.
Well, there's separate articles, so all right, so Representative Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, I would like to move 11.
Okay. So is there other discussion or amendments on Article 11? Now, Ms. Burris has pointed out that this reflects the spreadsheet that Ms. Boyd just went through. So, again, discussion or amendments? If not, Representative Carlson moves adoption of Article 11, the appropriations article, and allowing staff to make necessary conforming or technical changes. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries. Then we have Article 12, the Railroad Safety Article. So who would like to present that?
Mr. Chair and members, Matt Burris with House Research. Article 12 begins on page 20, and I'll walk through the sections in that article. Sections 1 and 2 are terms that are defined in the chapter on environmental response and is overseen by the Pollution Control Agency. The substantive language begins at the bottom of page 20, and that's section 4. All of these first sections were originally House-only language coming into the conference committee. The provision in section 4 establishes some requirements for railroads on providing training to local fire department and emergency response units, coordinating with local units of government as well as fire department officers and rail employees. It also establishes some response capability requirements for responding to spill or discharge events involving oil or hazardous substances. These are all requirements placed only on railroads in this proposed conference agreement. The original House language specified both rail and pipeline, so this has been modified from the original House language. There are a couple of different response timeline capabilities. That's in subdivision 4 of this section. And then on subdivision 5, there's a requirement on doing a drill every 3 years, and then finally submission to the PCA in subdivision 6 of an update and subsequent updates to prevention and response plans that are required under current law. So this would change the schedule a bit and require actual submission to the PCA. At the bottom of page 22, there's another, I believe, house-only provision that, again, was modified to apply only to railroads, and it establishes some new powers and duties of the PCA regarding pollution control and response preparedness for discharge events. And then in section 6 on page 23, there's railroad railroad-specific powers and duties established for the Department of Public Safety. So section 5 has the PCA powers and duties. Section 6 has the public safety powers and duties. Again, this has been modified to apply only to railroads in this proposal. Page 24 contains sections 7 and 8. This was previously adopted by the conference committee and increases the number of rail safety inspector positions at MnDOT. And that was touched on in the walkthrough of the spreadsheet on additional assessment funds that are then appropriated out to MnDOT for those positions. Section 9 is on page 25. This establishes the new program for the Department of Public Safety, creates a new rail safety account, and also sets up the assessment on railroads, and then directs the Department of Public Safety in how those funds should be used to establish some additional emergency management positions, provide training to local units of government to better address oil and hazardous materials discharge incidents. This was both House and Senate language. The difference between House and Senate on this revolved around whether pipelines were included. This is largely the Senate language that's specific to just pipelines. And this is...
It's not clear, is it?
I'm sorry. It's specific to just railroads. I've somehow managed to confuse the two over the course of the day, so my apologies. So this is railroad specific, and this includes the appropriation to PCA for their additional staffing duties on the PCA provisions that were discussed previously. Page 26 contains section 10, which is the both House and Senate provision. This was adopted by the conference committee earlier and is a MnDOT report on highway rail grade crossing safety and improvements. Section 11 is on page 27. There were similar versions of this between the House and Senate. This is substantially the House language and establishes two different reports that the Department of Public Safety is directed to do. There are some changes from the original House language so that the content of the report refers to just oil and not hazardous materials and refers to transportation of oil more generally rather than specifying modes. The first report of the two is due January 15th, 2015, and has some requirements around identifying current framework, current costs, information on that would form the basis for the allocation of the assessment funds that DPS would administer. And then the second report is due in 2017 under this version, which is a slightly different date from the original House language. This part was originally just proposed by the House, and this would be somewhat of an update to the first report as well as an evaluation and an analysis of kind of the state of things in a couple of years. One thing I neglected to mention earlier is the expiration of the assessment. There was a difference between the House and Senate, and this is partway in between so that the assessment would expire at the end of fiscal 2017. And that, Mr. Chair and members, concludes Article 12.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Burris. Questions for Mr. Burris or comments on Article 12? Okay. Representative Carlson.
I'd like to move the adoption of Article 12.
Okay.
Transportation Article 12.
Okay. Senator Tomasoni.
I don't know. Is this the only other article there is?
We have Article 13.
Well, this is something on for. I mean, I don't know much about this because this is Metro people stuff. But this is something that Senator Sieben asked me to offer, and I think it's the appropriate article to offer it to. It's an A178 amendment.
And I'll tell you what. Before that amendment is offered, I think Mr. Nauman has a technical amendment. If we could, believe. If we could do that.
Mr. Chairman, on page 25, line 21, I think to clarify where the appropriation is coming from, it would be helpful to say that after appropriated, insert from the rail safety account.
Okay.
Railroad safety account.
So Representative Carlson moves adoption of that amendment. Is there further discussion? Senator Dibble, did you catch that?
If I could see the amendment. Oh, I'm sorry. This is Mr. Nauman's technical amendment.
Yes.
Oh, no, that's fine. I thought we were talking about the Tomasoni amendment. Sorry, that's fine.
Okay. So we have Representative Carlson moving the technical amendment. All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed. Motion carries. Senator Tomasoni.
Okay, Mr. Chairman. your CA just took the amendment from you to make copies, but. I should maybe let Senator Dibble comment on this because it's really none of my business, but it's about the collared counties and trying to figure out how to do that. And I think the amendment, and it's up to you guys. It's about
just
putting
the vehicle?
It's about well, so it's a transportation. No,
so Mr.
It's a. Go ahead.
Let him struggle.
Well, it's
transportation. So I'm enjoying it.
It's about dealing with the collared counties in the forecast and making sure that the money that didn't get paid to the collared counties gets paid back in the forecast. And this comes to me from Senator Sieben, and so I'm offering it for her. It's up to you guys if you want to take it or not. So I'm just trying to send a message here. Okay.
So, Mr. Chair.
Senator Dibble.
Thanks. So I first heard that this was actually being put into amendment form this evening. But I know that this is an idea that's been discussed over the last number of weeks. And I believe what it seeks to do, I haven't really seen it. I think what it seeks to do is similar to you know, what we did for the airports fund shift that occurred that got paid back after the school shift was fully taken care of. I think it's similar to what Senator Tomasoni is trying to do with the 21st Century Minerals Fund, you know, with lifting the motor vehicle lease tax cap. The collared counties are getting $13 million back this year of what would have been $22 million because of the growth in that fund. I think what this accomplishes is if there's a forecast, there's a surplus in forecasted revenues beyond what had been anticipated after the payback of the 21st Century Mineral Funds, the additional $9 that would then be needed after the $13 to get to the $22 would be paid back to this fund for the collar counties.
All right. We have the A-178 amendment in front of us. Is there further discussion? Representative Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, you know, I think it's important to look at the last part of the amendment here. It also deals with the 21st Century Fund. This payback would be after the payback of the 21st Century Fund, and that issue is under discussion under Jobs and Economic Development. We did, or we are in here lifting the cap for the Ring counties, which moves $13 million over to the Ring counties this year. So I think we should probably take a look at this more carefully than just grabbing this tonight, especially when it does cross over into the jurisdiction of another committee. So I would encourage a no vote.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chairman, why don't I just withdraw the amendment?
Okay, the amendment's been withdrawn. Is there further discussion on Article 12? Representative Wagenius.
I have an amendment that's A272 that has been, been doing.
Okay, Representative Wagenius, if we could just wait till it's been distributed.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'm going to ask you maybe if you can speak a little bit.
Well, I'm not going to have to speak loudly because Representative Hornstein is going to tell you about the amendment.
Okay. Well, it's still being distributed, so.
Mr. Chair.
So Representative Wagenius moves the A272 amendment. I think we've got it now just about. So Representative Hornstein.
Mr. Chair, in consultation with Mr. Burris, I think procedurally it may be advisable to vote on this article now as it's been presented, which I think doesn't have a lot of controversy to it. This next one does, and I think Mr. Burris thought that you might want to move what you've already discussed and then move on to this amendment. But is that correct, Mr. Burris?
Mr. Burris.
Mr. Chair and members, I would defer to the conference committee staff on that, but the way this amendment is structured would be to modify this working document in Article 12 by removing a couple of the sections that are proposed in there and replacing them with some alternative versions of those sections, just so that the committee is aware of structurally what would take place.
Okay, we'll hold on that.
So, Representative Carlson.
I move adoption of Article 12.
Okay, so Representative Carlson moves adoption of Article 12. Further discussion on that and move the article with instructions to staff to make appropriate technical conforming amendments. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Then Representative Wagenius on the A272 amendment.
Representative Hornstein is going to present the amendment.
Okay. Representative Hornstein.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, and thank you very much, committee members. In terms of the last section, I also want to appreciate the work that was done with the railroads on these items. We came to some consensus on those. As some of you know, and we've been distributed a couple of editorials and some information from the Pollution Control Agency and Department of Public Safety, there is a piece that there are some differences between the House and Senate on, and that does relate to the issue of including pipelines in the overall oil transportation safety provisions that are included in our bill here. And so what this amendment does is it includes some of the pipeline language from the House. There are other provisions that are not included. And I would ask perhaps if council could go through that, talk about the what's in the amendment and some of the changes that are from the original House version. And I would just add that while the oil train issue has been very front and center in the news, we had just two derailments in the country over the last 10 days since this conference committee has been meeting. There also have been issues with pipelines, which carry actually more oil than trains through the state. And so it's appropriate, we feel, that some language be included to address that issue. So I'll just defer now to Mr. Burris to go through the amendment.
Mr. Burris.
Mr. Chair and members, as was noted, the thrust of the amendment is to include pipelines in addition to railroads in some of the requirements that are put into place in Article 12 on preparedness for discharges and public safety general preparedness. A couple of the highlights on this are pulling or including pipelines in the communication coordination requirement that's at subdivision 3 at the bottom of page 1. And then some of the response capability provisions, but not all of them, would, under the amendment, include pipelines as well. That would include a kind of general requirement on deploying sufficient personnel and equipment following a confirmed spill, general capability in deploying a containment boom, which is a floating material that's placed on the water to keep oil or other materials from spreading on water locations. A couple of timeline-based requirements on an 8-hour timeline for providing some degree of staff and materials for unlimited containment capacity, as well as a 60-hour timeline on full containment capacity being provided by the pipelines. There's some technical changes that go along with that. And also now on page 3, subdivision 6, pipeline companies would be included in the requirements on submitting a updated prevention and response plan and the new cycle that would go along with that. The amendment also would include pipelines in the general powers and duties that are expressed for both the PCA, and that's in section 5, and then the Department of Public Safety in section 6. And then on section, I'll just note one other technical thing with the amendment at the bottom of page 4. The page number is left off at 4.34. That should be page 25.
Again, that'll be incorporated into the amendment.
And then, Mr. Chair and members, on page 5, section 9 contains the provisions around the Department of Public Safety setting up a program, and as well as the account that would receive the transferred funds and the assessment funds. A lot of this language is the same. The key changes are that the amount appropriated to PCA would be increased to $208,000. And the technical change that Mr. Nauman had pointed out earlier could be incorporated again in here. And then one of the key items is the assessments would increase to $2.5 million. That would be the same amount that's in place under the original adopted language for the railroads, and then the pipelines would be included in for the other half of that assessment amount. The expiration date stays the same. And just speaking again generally to the amendment, a lot of the language is the same, and the essence of it is including pipelines in a number of the requirements.
Okay. All right. Senator Tomasoni?
Mr. Chairman, I hope we wouldn't adopt this amendment. You know, the Office of Pipeline Safety does almost all of this stuff. In fact, I think they do it all. And I think this is duplication of what's being done already and being done very well. And I think since the Office of Pipeline Safety has taken over the pipeline safety issue in this country since 1992, there have been virtually no problems whatsoever. I have pipelines going through my district and touring the pump station in Floodwood. It's they are extremely careful about being very, very safe and very, very clean. And I was very, very impressed with the operation. We didn't have anything like this in the Senate bill, and I would hope that that we would not adopt this in the conference committee right now.
Okay. Representative Hornstein?
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Senator Tomasoni. I guess there's been some confusion on this issue of jurisdiction, which I just wanted to clarify. Senator Tomasoni is correct that the Department of Public Safety, MNOPS, the Office of Pipeline Safety does have a regulation of the actual pipelines. But what we're talking about here with the new jurisdiction jurisdictional responsibilities of the PCA are to address issues once the oil is spilled or there's an accident. And we know that these are rare. There have been pipeline spills and accidents since 1991, some fairly large scale in the state. But what we're talking about here is a very rare event. When the Department of Public Safety testified in the House, they talked about a low-frequency, high-impact event. And so once there is a spill, once there is a problem, that is the responsibility of the environmental agency, the pollution control agency, to respond. And when we addressed this issue with the Department of Public Safety and the Office of Pipeline Safety, they concurred. They currently don't have the staff or the training or the know-how to be responsive to a spill and the expertise. So the issue here is, and I think there's a couple of provisions that are particularly important that we have, and that's an 8-hour timeline for providing oil containment staff and equipment. In a worst-case spill, that they, in 8 hours, have the capability to at least clean up 10% of that. And then a 60-hour timeline, over 2 days, for providing oil recovery staff and equipment for full containment. So what we're talking about here is in a very serious accident, that there are some specific timelines and benchmarks met, and that the PCA, who has the expertise and it's within their jurisdiction, can then be charged with responding to that. And again, I think some people may argue that 8 hours is way too lenient, or 60 hours is way too lenient. But these are important timeline benchmarks, because when there is an accident, God forbid, it'll be the public officials that are taken to task. Why weren't people on the scene faster? Why didn't you get here faster? Because that's when a lot of the environmental damage takes place. And as we know with past oil spills and problems with oil, it can take years, even decades, to fully clean this up. So this is about cleaning up accidents once they happen. And so I just wanted to clarify that, because there has been some misunderstanding about the role of the Pollution Control Agency in this bill.
Okay, Representative Mahoney.
Mr. Chair, and I'm not sure whether I should ask if there's someone who can answer this particular question, but have we had recent spills in Minnesota from pipelines? And when and where?
Mr. Chair, I know there have been some, and I know there may be some people in the audience that could give some very specific information on that. I don't know if there's someone from the... Yeah, we have some folks that are here. But is there someone from the Pollution Control Agency or MnOps or Department of Public Safety that could document?
Yeah. If you'd like to testify, just identify yourself, and welcome to the conference committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, I'm John Wolfgram, Chief Engineer with the Minnesota Office of Pipeline Safety. And just to, I guess, to kind of follow up on Representative Hornstein's comment, yes, I mean, we have had spills historically in Minnesota. Let me start over here again. We do have a threshold for reporting in the state of Minnesota. It could be anything up to, a 5-gallon spill would be something that would be reported to our office, and that is something that, we do take in these small spills on kind of a routine basis in the state of Minnesota.
So, Mr. Chair, and if he can stay there, but Representative Hornstein, are we talking about 5-gallon oil spills?
No, we're not, actually. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Mahoney. And we have had a couple of major pipeline spills. We're updating. We're actually updating existing law in this amendment. And existing law was written in 1991 after a major spill, and I think we've had a couple of others since then, but I see that Ms. Allers-Nelson is here and maybe can answer your question more specifically, Representative Mahoney.
Certainly. Have we had, Mr. Chair?
Representative Mahoney.
To the new testifier, what kind of spills are we talking about, and how many have we had? I don't think that one works.
Thank you. Mr. Chair and committee members, for the record, my name is Courtney Allers-Nelson, and I'm with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. I have a list here in front of me of numerous spills from pipelines, and my list only contains those that were over 10,000 gallons. So I apologize. I haven't totaled them up at the moment, but I can tell you that the most recent and significant spill took place in 2012 in Apple Valley, and that was 63,000 gallons. What's very interesting about that and the importance for a response is that that particular spill took place in a highly populated area where the soils, the environmental conditions, resulted in quite a bit of the oil being lost to seepage to the environment. So in that, again, that case, getting there quickly, being able to deploy equipment and personnel to recover as much of that oil as possible was critical. Unfortunately, as I mentioned, quite a bit was still lost to the environment. But as for a total, I'll have to take a moment just to total them up. There's at least 20 here on my page of spills since 1991, over 10,000 gallons.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair, if I might.
Mr. Mahoney.
So how soon are you typically, how soon is someone typically getting to an oil spill? If they're reported within, how fast are they reporting them typically, and how fast are they getting there to address them? And I don't care which one of the pipeline safety.
Yes, I can answer that. The code does require that they do a report to us, pipeline safety, promptly, and the federal jurisdiction for these pipeline operators would say that promptly was within an hour. I've had a chance to kind of follow up on the first question here regarding the amount of spilled. Since 2004, gross barrels of product spilled in Minnesota have been 18,124 barrels of product loss, just to answer the first question to follow up. And we would receive a notification from a representative of the pipeline company typically within an hour that they've had some type of spill.
Mr. Chair. So, Representative Hornstein, how would this change our response to that? Would it be faster? Would it be slower? Would it be more efficient?
Mr. Chair and Representative Mahoney, I would say yes on all of those. And, again, I would defer to our agencies that have the technical expertise.
Well,
to,
then
to
I'll ask the agencies. Would this amendment make our response faster, better, more effective, more efficient? I mean, I don't know. Could we have gotten to the spill in Apple Valley sooner? And if we had, would it have stopped? What would we have been able to clean up faster if the soil conditions were such? As you indicated that they were pretty poor soil and it flowed fast into the soil.
Mr. Chair and Representative Mahoney, I don't have all the specifics on this particular spill, so I apologize. I can't get into any great detail. But I think what I wanted to stress is absolutely the timing. And environmental conditions are going to vary across the state, as we're all well aware. And response times may need to vary as well. But I do want to point out the nuance between your question and what the bill language is achieving. Your question was about response and notification. So I'm sure my cohort here at MinOps, John, would agree that they must notify us promptly. And in state statute, it says rapidly and thoroughly. Not only do they notify, but respond. So we can absolutely expect that we would be notified of a spill likely within an hour. But the bill language refers to responding to the actual site with personnel, with equipment, and the capabilities to recover as much as possible, at least 10% of the worst case calculated spill.
Okay, we've got the A272 amendment in front of us. Is there further discussion? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
Motion fails. All right. We've had, thank you for the testimony. We've had the adoption of Article 12. Are there further amendments to Article 12? If not, Mr. Burris, did you want to explain? Ms. Borofsky is going to explain Article 13 to us.
Mr. Chair and members, Article 13 contains a number of transportation finance provisions, and many of these have already been adopted by the conference committee, but I will run through them quickly. Section 1 is Senate language, and it dedicates a segment of U.S. Highway 61 as the Trooper Glenn Skullman Memorial Highway. Section 2 was in both Senate and House, but the Senate language was slightly different, and that was adopted here. And this Section 2 allows, it expands the permissible uses of funds in the Stillwater Lift Bridge Endowment account so they can be used for bridge safety inspections and reactive repairs. Section 3 also was adopted. This is Senate language authorizing the issuance of a special license plate to promote the game of golf, Minnesota golf plates, and it entails a $30 minimum annual contribution to the Minnesota Section PGA Foundation account along with the plate fees. Sections 4 through 8 have not been adopted by the conference committee, although they've been reviewed, and this is the work zone safety language. This is Senate language. Sections 4 through 8 redefine work zone. They establish two petty misdemeanors. Each carries a mandatory fine of $300 plus the $75 statutory surcharge. One is disobedience to a flagger, and the other one is speeding in a work zone. These sections also specify the extent to which a speed limit can be lowered in a work zone, but the adjusted speed limits are not effective unless there are signs posted. After the work zone sections is Section 9, and this is adopted Senate language that allows a vehicle operated by a commercial vehicle inspector of the Department of Public Safety to use the crossover that's allowed between the lanes of a controlled access highway. Then sections 10 to 18 are Senate and House, and these sections have to do with annual overweight permit for commercial vehicle, different types of commercial vehicles. And they provide, in essence, that an applicant for a vehicle on request, for an overweight vehicle permit on request, can have the expiration date of the overweight permit coincide with the expiration date of the vehicle registration period, and then pay a proportional permit fee if the period is less than 1 year. That takes us all the way to Section 19. Section 19 has not been adopted yet by the conference committee, and that relates to motorized bicycle operator permits. It consolidates two existing permits relating to motorized bicycle operation into a single motorized bicycle operator's permit that's valid up to age 21. Section 20 is Senate language adding to the list of driver's licenses a commercial learner's permit for a fee of $2.50. Section 21. This is House language that is actually not in either of the underlying bills that are in conference, but it was adopted on the House floor in connection with the motorized bicycle permit language. And what Section 21 would accomplish is to require the Commissioner of Public Safety to make available driver exams for eligible applicants, within 14 days of the applicant's request for a road test. That's just what applies to road tests. And it's effective May 1, 2015. Section 22 provides that state law regarding licensure for driving commercial vehicles and also operation of commercial motor vehicles is subject to federal law, and if there's any conflict, federal law prevails. Section 23 is Senate language, and that allows the Commissioner of Transportation to bill certain operation to bill its own internal operations units for centrally managed products and services. Section 24 is Senate language that provides that funds in the transportation economic development account are available until expended. Section 26 is a version of this language was, wait a minute here. Section 25 is Senate language adjusting, and the House had similar language. It adjusts the minimum against which MnDOT measures its required level of spending for these transportation alternatives projects. It's compared to comparable spending over during 2010 to 2012. Section 26 is Senate language, and that directs MnDOT to include in its annual major highway projects report to the legislature a statement of efficiencies achieved during the previous two fiscal years, and this begins in 2016. The House had similar language as well. Section 27 is compromise language. Both the Senate and House had language that related to railroad yard lighting, and this is language that was worked out between the Senate and House. Subdivision 1 requires Class 1 and Class 2 railroad carriers that operate railroad yards in the state where certain work is done in the dark in the yards, and that would be frequently, that it's done frequently, and the type of work is switching, repair, inspection, and assembly and disassembly of trains. And so these carriers that operate yards where this work is done frequently have to submit to MnDOT annually a plan that describes the type of lighting that they have in the yards and that sets a timeline for meeting certain lighting standards within these yards. In Subdivision 2, there is a requirement that railroad carriers that are required to submit reports have to also maintain the lighting that they have. And if there is a malfunction that's reported to the railroad, it has to be repaired or replaced within 48 hours after the report. Subdivision 3 also requires worker union representatives at each yard to report to MnDOT annually about the status and adequacy of the lighting in their yards. Then MnDOT will read these reports and compare them, and if there are any discrepancies between the railroad company's reports and the union representatives' reports, they have to investigate the discrepancies and report those in connection with an annual report to the legislature as to the progress made by these railroad companies in lighting up their yards for night work. And Subdivision 5 is a requirement that a railroad carrier establish lighting in a railroad yard that meets certain characteristics that are spelled out in Subdivision 5, including its location within 2 miles of a petroleum refinery, having a specific crude oil production capacity. Section 28 is Senate and House compromise language, and this amends the statutory distribution of motor vehicle lease sales tax revenues so that the amount that's available for distribution each year after the $32 million is held back would be 50-50 between the 5 metropolitan collar counties and Greater Minnesota Transit. This 50-50 split would begin in fiscal year 2015, and current statute begins that 50-50 split in 2016. Section 29 is both House and Senate language, and this directs the Commissioner of Public Safety to establish an Office of State Safety Oversight within the department to make sure that the fixed guideway public transportation systems meet certain federal safety standards. Section 30 is a Senate provision that requires the Metropolitan Council to adopt light rail vehicle design standards that would promote accessibility as well as health and safety, and then in their procurement of vehicles following adoption of these standards, the new vehicles would have to meet the standards. The standards would have to be reviewed with the Transportation Accessibility Advisory Committee. Certain minimum standards are set out in that section. Section 31 is House language, and that language has to do with transit shelters and stops, and it establishes certain requirements for transit shelter design and maintenance. Section 32 is Senate and House language, and this requires the MnDOT to include in its 2015 major highway projects report information on efficiencies implemented that year, identifying the level of savings achieved and identifying projects that were advanced due to the savings achieved by these efficiencies. Section 33 is House language, and this directs the DNR and MnDOT to cooperate in using rest areas for watercraft decontamination with current funding. Section 34 is a provision that places into law a settlement agreement that was reached concerning the turnback of Highway 14. And this is related to appropriations that Ms. Boyd spoke about before. And this directs the commissioner, or actually it authorizes the commissioner to take over old Highway 14, to fix it up, and to turn it back to Steele and Waseca counties. And Section 35 is Senate language directing MnDOT by 2019 to perform an investigation of all of the two-lane, two-way trunk highways that are posted at 55 miles per hour to see if the speed limits could be reasonably and safely increased, and then, if so, to increase them, and to report over the next 5 years to the legislature as to the actions taken under this section, which then expires in 2019. Section 36 is Senate-only language in this bill, and this establishes the Task Force on Motor Vehicle Insurance Coverage Verification. The goal is to recommend legislation to create and fund a program to verify the existence of motor vehicle insurance for particular drivers, and there is a report due in February of 2015, after which the task force sunsets. Section 37 is Senate and House with some compromise language that I believe MnDOT had requested, and this is the establishment of a pilot program, a community destination sign pilot program in the city of Two Harbors. And MnDOT would establish the program. And the section describes which types of attractions and destinations may be noted on the signs, what the signs would look like, and so on. The city is required to pay all of the costs, and then MnDOT will evaluate the pilot program by 2021. And finally, Section 38 is transit service on Election Day, and this applies both to MnDOT and the Metropolitan Council, as well as the replacement service suburban providers and contract providers, that they are required to provide fixed-route public transit rides free of charge on Election Day just this November. It's just a one-year or one-time provision. And that concludes the policy, Article 13.
So on that final section, Section 38, because I noted that in the House bill, so who can get a free ride on Election Day? Is that anybody or?
Mr. Chair, it's open to anyone.
So, and this would be provided by any transit operator, so the bus system in the Twin Cities?
Mr. Chair, yes, the Metro Transit, any fixed route provider, so it wouldn't apply to dial-a-rides. Or that type of personalized service. But for fixed route, it would apply in the Twin Cities.
So how do we know that I'm going to vote when I get on a bus?
We know you're
Mr. Chair, there's no requirement that you go vote.
So
it's open to anyone for any purpose on Election Day.
So it's just a free bus ride day if I want to go shop downtown or go to a movie. Is that...
Mr. Chair, that's my understanding. It's a House provision, but yes.
That was Mr. Chairman. That was a provision that Representative Ray Dean proposed that passed our Government Operations Committee, our Elections Committee, and the Transportation Committees. And I don't believe that he had any restrictions on, and, like, you didn't have to show your ID or anything like that.
And the Met Council is. Okay with this?
The Met Council did not oppose the...
So even though you might have ridership that has nothing to do with going to vote.
The understanding is that there are some people that would not be able to vote if they didn't have transportation, and this would help them get to the polls.
Mr. Chair.
Sir Bono.
Mr. Chair, I too just have been so just kind of not really understanding sort of the intent of this particular provision. Is there a fiscal cost then to the Met Council? Are they just absorbing that, or are we carrying it on the spreadsheet?
Representative Horns.
Mr. Chair, Senator Bonoff, yes, there is a fiscal cost that we're paying out of our – it's a one-time expense, one-time general fund. And again, the intent of the author of this bill, and I've talked with him, is to provide access to the polls for those that don't have it. And I think in his research and his preparation of this bill, this was where he came down.
Thank you.
And Representative Hornstein, just to finish the discussion or my last comment, I like the concept. I like the idea of providing transportation service to people who would like to vote but who have a difficult time getting to the polling place, even if it's in the vicinity of that person's home. So I like the concept. And I recognize that the provision is only for this year's election to see how it works. I'm a little bit concerned about whether or not there might be some abuse of this provision. And I recognize it's probably pretty difficult, you know, that somebody can only get on the bus if they have an I voted sticker or something. So I realize there, you know, enforcement's difficult, but I'm curious to see how this will work and hope it works in the way that's intended.
Did vote today.
It's
a prop. So, Sarah Dibble.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And I just thought I'd point out to Senator Bonoff's inquiry. If you look on the spreadsheet, the Greater Minnesota costs are $32,000, and you can see that on line 12 of the spreadsheet. And then the Metro Transit or the Metropolitan Area on line 89, page 2 of the spreadsheet, at $144,000.
Okay. Further questions?
And Mr. Chair, I didn't not wear the sticker to promote the House provision. I actually did vote today. I got myself there, though.
You drove in your car there.
Yeah. I'm ashamed to say yes, I did.
So we have Article 13 in front of us. Is there further discussion, amendments? Representative Carlson?
Yes, I move Article 13, and I guess we neglected with the earlier ones to also include the language giving staff the authority to make necessary corrections. So I would include that in this motion for all three articles.
So we have the motion by Representative Carlson and Article 13. All those in favor, if there's no further discussion, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. So, members of the conference committee, that would conclude this evening. Let me just, tomorrow we still have further work to do. We'll see where we are in terms of House and Senate sessions. Obviously, we've got economic development. We've got environment. We have E-12. And so we do have a lot of work to do tomorrow. Would also remind members that although we've adopted articles, the entire conference committee is still open to further work on any of the previously adopted articles if the conferees so choose. Only other thing is I want to talk to the Senate conferees for just 1 minute over here. So further